gentlemen. I'm Craig Dunbar, and I'm an alcoholic. Very grateful to be here. Thank you, Billy. Where are you, Billy? Thank you, Billy, for asking me to come down. My sobriety date is July 16th, 1999. I have a home group. I have a sponsor. I actually listen to him once in a while. And I try and work the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and practice these principles in my affairs on a daily basis. And I think those four things have been described to me as tentposts, foundations, and I believe those four things have helped me maintain sobriety. It's good to be back in Madison. I have a little history down here. I'll get to it in my story, I guess. I don't usually, but tonight I'll talk a little bit about Madison because I did some serious drinking down here. what it was like. I believe that the doctor's opinion described what it was like for me. He said that men and women basically drink because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And that was me. I loved the effect produced by alcohol, and I loved what it did for me. I picked up my first drink of alcohol. Some of you all from down here in the country, so and some of you are old enough to remember that Buicks used to have their own dealerships. And I picked up my first drink of alcohol in the back of a Buick garage with a bunch of guys I just finished a football game with. And, wow, man, did I like that stuff. I should have known right away everybody had a beer and I tried to drink the rest of the case, you know. But that didn't faze me. That was in 1959. And I gave you my sobriety date, so for those mathematicians out there, I drank for 40 years. And for me, it was a very progressive, a slowly progressive illness. I enjoyed drinking. I didn't drink all the time at first. I drank on occasions. Generally, in high school, I drank when it was available. I don't know, somewhere our book tells us I was described as one of those that at some point in my drinking, I could have stopped. I still controlled what I did, and I functioned that way for a number of years. And I'm not sure exactly when it was. I believe I've been able to pinpoint it somewhere in 1967 or 68. I crossed that line. Where I no longer controlled my drinking controlled me. I didn't know it. And between 1969 and 1999, my illness progressed, again, slowly. I progressed to, by 1969, I was drinking every day. And every day, it was 5 o'clock, and then it was 5 o'clock somewhere. And you know how it goes, and it just got worse and worse and worse for me. At the end, there's about 22 months of my life toward the latter part of 1997 to the spring of 1999, it's pretty fuzzy for me. I was drinking what we used to call half gallons, 1.75 liters of distilled spirits a day. To do that, you got to drink all the time. And that's what I was doing. I don't know how I got this illness. I never saw either of my parents take a drink of alcohol. I didn't grow up with it. I have three siblings. I have an older brother that drank too much once and blacked out, according to his story, and came to, and there was a little old lady crossing the sidewalk in front of him. And our book describes him, too. He just quit. And that was about 25 years ago. He hadn't had a drink since. My younger brother drinks once in a while. My kid sister, I spent some time with her in California recently, and she and I used to have Sunday dinners together, and she would cook, real good cook. She'd pour herself a glass of wine as she started cooking. And then I'd eat the great meal she'd prepare for us, and then I'd clean up afterwards. And she abuses alcohol. I would have to pour out probably half to three-quarters of that glass of wine that she needed to cook the dinner, you know. And I quit saying anything after a while, you know. It was on mute ears there. So I don't know where it came from, but certainly I did cross that point. Across that line, and as I said, I was what the book describes, I guess, as a functioning alcoholic. I went to work every day until about 1998, and I went to school, I went to college. I was talking with this gentleman earlier. I thought I was unique in a lot of ways. I was born during the war, but I went to high school in a small town in Ohio called Chagrin Falls, tiny little place. And to my knowledge, it's the only place in the world called Chagrin Falls. And from there, I moved to another place that's the only place in the world called Mule Shoe, Texas. So I was unique, you see. I thought I was unique when I got in here, too. The first thing that happened to me, I'll back up and tell you exactly how I got here, but the first thing that happened to me when I got here, I was handed this book by a guy I used to drink with. And he said the answer to all my problems are in this book. And that was 9 1/2 some years ago. And I have not found him wrong yet. This is our basic text. I've come to believe that the best way to practice this program for me is to study this text and do what it says. And that's what I've tried to do. And I went to college. I played football in college until I got hurt. Not playing football, riding a motorcycle. I had joined the Marine Corps, and the motorcycle accident contributed to that mess, and I didn't know what to do, so I ended up going to law school. You know, we don't regret the past, but I wish to hell I hadn't gone to law school. I practiced law. I was a trial lawyer for 30 years, and my drinking really really progressed. The further I got into trying cases, the more I thought I had earned the right to sit down and drink alcohol. And, of course, then the more I did it. The problem with that is it becomes very difficult to practice law when you're as drunk as I was all the time. And I actually tried to make a court appearance drunk once, and it not recommended. It's lucky I didn't end up locked up. But that's where I ended up anyway, locked up. I over the course of the years, I didn't realize this till I sat down with a correctional officer at one point, and I'll get to that later in the story, but over the course of the years, I've learned I had been arrested 17 times, and I'm sure you'll find it amazing that they were all alcohol-related. Everything from drunk in public to, unfortunately, assaulting a police lieutenant in the city of Baltimore. That one was not a good one. It's a wonder that I kept my license to practice law as long as I did. I did get smart, you know. I was pretty slick. I tried not to drive when I'd been drinking. One time I remember I spent $55 to take a cab back from Oriole Park at Camden, or the old Oriole Park, back to Alexandria, Virginia, and then I had, of course, had to get the car the next day. So I didn't have any real driving problems with the law. I had driving problems with my wife. That older brother I was telling you about, he's in the automobile business, and he's got some repo guys that work for him. And at the end, my wife and my older brother kept repoing my car. I'd like to think that they were worried about me hurting myself, but I think they were scared to death I was going to kill somebody else at that point. I don't think they cared whether I would kill myself. I'd about worn out my welcome with my family, especially my wife. Like I said, I don't know when I crossed the line, but certainly at the end, I had no control over when I took a drink. And certainly once I put any alcohol anywhere near me, the phenomenon of craving developed, and I just kept drinking. Now, I indicated to you, I thought I was unique, and I was given this book, and I read Bill's story, and I said, I'm not anything like that guy, because I never tried to stop drinking. I never had a desire to stop drinking, and I didn't go through the things that are in this book that describe the painful next days. And I was in a real quandary one day early on, and I shared at a meeting that just what I shared with you, and an old-timer came up to me, and he said, you didn't have any hangovers? And I said, nope. He said, me either. He said, how much did you drink? And I told him, he said, you know, he said, you're like a lot of us. He said, you were drunk all the time. If you're drunk all the time, you're not going to have hangovers. He said, you didn't try to quit either, did you? And I said, no, sir. He said, me either. And he looked at me and he said, you're here by the grace of God, just like I am. Don't ever forget it. And I have. I believe we're all here by the grace of God. I certainly know my experience is that's why I'm here. At the end, I never got fired from a job because I had my own law practice. If I'd have been smart, I'd have fired myself. You know, wasn't that smart. Got so I couldn't make a living practicing law. I had hooked up with some other alcoholics and set them up in a wonderful business for alcoholics to be in. It's called the liquor business. So, I had set up this company, and we were importing wine from the Hunter Valley region of Australia. He was one of these guys, was an Australian, and had grown up on a vineyard over there. And we got this opportunity when the Soviet Union broke apart. We got the opportunity to bring in some pretty unique vodka from the Ukraine. And so I quit practicing law, and I went in the distilled spirits business, importing vodka from the Ukraine. Not a good thing for an alcoholic to do. At this point, I had been living off the federal government for a number of years by not paying withholding taxes or income taxes. And I needed all this money to go in the liquor business because I knew that was going to solve all my problems. So the government calls it wire fraud. I'm going to be honest with you all. I stole a lot of money. That's what I did. Money that had been entrusted to me as a lawyer. And I'm not going to sit up here or stand up here this evening and tell you alcohol caused me to do that. I can't blame that on my illness. I would like to think it wouldn't have happened had I not been drunk all the time. But that's something I'll never know because I was drunk all the time. And I started buying this vodka by the container load. I'm sure you all know what a ship container looks like. And I had six containers sitting on a dock up in New Jersey. And three of them are still sitting there. No one knew what I had been doing. So here I was, you talk about remorse and guilt and wanting things to be different. And the answer was just to drink it away for me. That's my experience. But, you know, I'm like I think most of us are. We realize that we've got a problem. I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I could not control alcohol. But I thought my life was manageable. You know, I know a lot of us get in here thinking that their life's unmanageable, but that they can control alcohol. Step one doesn't say and, there's a little dash there. And it says we're alcoholic, our lives are unmanageable. And that's my experience. I did think I had this crazy, peculiar mental twist that we that have this illness all have. You know, before I picked up a drink, you know, it was okay. You know, I'd look at that drink, I'd pour the drink, and I'd say in my mind, this time will be different. And of course it wasn't. Other than it got worse. And the next time I poured the drink, I'd say, this time will be different. This time will be different. And it never was. That's the alcoholic insanity that we have with this illness. And that's the insanity that my book told me that I had to come to believe that there was something other than me that could take that away from me. I'm going to share something with you all that I have not shared in 9.5 years, other than with a sponsor. A lot of things we tell sponsors in step four and in step five as a result of step four that aren't good material for a speaker. This is not one of those things. This is a personal thing that I just don't talk about usually. But I think coming down the road tonight, and I had a lot of reminiscing, and I'll get to that a little bit later too. But I'm bringing this up tonight just as it has to do with step two and coming to believe that there's a power greater than ourselves. I grew up in a religion that in some ways is very akin to the principles set out in our book. But there are some other things in the religion that that I think are crazy. I was brought up a Christian Scientist. If any of you know what that is, if you don't, basically, the thing that I think is crazy, they think that the human mind can heal the body. They don't go to doctors. As a result, when I was 17 years old, my mother, who believed she didn't have to go to a doctor and did, died. So when I got to AA, I didn't really like God. In fact, I had a real problem with God. Fortunately, our book is not about religion. It's about spirituality. And it's not about the God that we were brought up with. And I was told I had to find a power greater than myself that I understood was not going to be the kind of God that I grew up with. It's going to be a loving, compassionate, all-knowing, all-powerful, all-seeing, all-present, higher power that if I developed a faith with, would relieve me of the obsession to drink alcohol. Fortunately, I was desperate when I got here. I had the gift of desperation. I told you how much I was drinking. Things got really crazy at the end. That my wife had thrown me out. I had agreed with her to sell the house. She changed all the locks. We'd lived in this house in Alexandria for almost 20 years. And I kept breaking into the house. And she called the police, and the police kept telling her they can't do anything to an owner who's breaking into his own house. Although I got to tell you, I was rudely awakened upon one of these break-ins, and I was passed out upstairs. This is on the second floor, and I was passed out upstairs. Now, I'll back up a little bit, because I got to explain why there were 9 policemen there, and all in flak jackets. Another idea I had, you see, I didn't steal this money in my alcoholic mind. I borrowed it. I was investing other people's money. I was going to make them a fortune. And when the liquor business wasn't going like I thought it should, and I was blaming it all on these other drunks that I was partners with, because I had the business sold to Jim Beam. We were going to make a fortune. They screwed it all up. Our book tells us, you can have everything going right, and what's the solution? This time will be different. Yeah. So I had this other harebrained idea and ran into these people that needed some automatic weapons. So I was going to go in the weapons business. I had a Class A certificate from ABTF. Man, you talk about a license, especially for a drunk. I could get on airplanes with open bottles. I could drive automobiles around anywhere with open bottles, sample bottles. And the state could not ticket me or do anything about it, unless, of course, I was drunk and operating the vehicle. So what happened was I went to Florida. I promised my wife I was going to go down to Hazleton down there in Palm Beach or wherever it was. This is after she had already, I went through a bunch of treatment deals, you know, Arlington Hospital, Fairfax Hospital, Alexandria Hospital. I've forgotten them all now. At one point when she knew that when she threw me out and changed the locks, we had a boat up in Maryland. She tried and tried and tried to get me committed in Virginia. You cannot commit somebody, at least you couldn't back then. I don't know what it's like now, but you can't commit somebody for being an alcoholic in Virginia. You couldn't then. Now, in Maryland, you can't commit somebody for being an alcoholic, but you can sign a petition saying they're crazy and because of their drinking, which you can't do in Virginia. So she knew that if she changed the locks on the house and she moved out to an apartment, she knew I would go up to the boat, which was in Maryland. Now, you got to have two people sign. So my younger brother is a resident in Maryland. He and my wife signed a petition. And I'm passed out on the boat one day, and here's the Maryland State Police. And they've got a warrant. I said, what kind of warrant? Well, it's a civil warrant. So I was, as our book promises, you know, you keep drinking, you're going to end up in jails, institutions, or dead. So I ended up in Shepherd Pratt Mental Hospital at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. I went through that program. Of course, the minute I got out, and I did go through periods. I went through 38 days there where I didn't take a drink. But, you know, I look back now, all they did was give me alcohol in a different form for me. You know, they gave me a bunch of little white pills. Here, this will take care of you, you know. And, you know, it wasn't any different anymore. Me looking at that drink, thinking it's going to be different, taking that pill wasn't any different either. So I got out of there and I went right to the liquor store. Chartwell was another place over on the Eastern Shore. Boy, those people were crazy. They wanted you to quit drinking, and back in the barn, everybody had all this dope, and everybody in that place was all smoked up. And I said, this isn't for me. Drugs are not a part of my story, so you're not going to hear anything about them tonight other than I really didn't do them. And the reason is, you know, I'm unlike our former president. I tried them. I actually inhaled that stuff. But drugs for me, I put a drug in my system and I lose control. I didn't like that. Now, alcohol, I could control. That's the insanity, the real insanity for an alcoholic. So I, back to the bedroom, I went into this this crazy scheme to buy all these automatic weapons, and I had a friend. In fact, he used to come down here with me once in a while. He's dead now, too, John. He owned the gun store in Alexandria City. They still have one, you know. They don't like it, but they can't get rid of the kids. Even John's dead. But so I'm trying to buy all these weapons, and that's why these police are all in my house with the flak jackets on. They're asking me where the weapons are. I'm drunk. What are you doing? Of course, I'm so drunk I don't say, where's your warrant? If I had, they'd have had to leave. But they actually led me down a flight of stairs, through a living room, out my front lawn, into the street, and arrested me for being drunk in public. That's how much I was liked in the city of Alexandria. I was walking around with a pistol on my hip. You know, because back then in Virginia, you could carry a firearm as long as it wasn't concealed. And you couldn't go into the bank, I found out, with it. So I what happened was I went down to Florida to go to this treatment deal, and of course I didn't. I just stayed drunk for a couple weeks, and I got back up here and broke in the house again, and my car's gone again. And I came to, and there's no furniture in the house. I'm passed out on the kitchen floor, but I found some alcohol I'd hidden around, you know. Here I've got six containers of this stuff, and I had it all over the place. You know, I had flasks hidden everywhere and bottles hidden everywhere. You know, we're crazy. I was crazy. So I found some, and I'm 6 o'clock in the morning, and I'm drinking between 6 and 9 because I'm waiting for the car dealer to open up. I'm going to go buy a new car. You know, they keep stealing my car. I'll just get another one. And I went up to Cadillac dealer and bought a car. I needed to get to Annapolis and collect some money. I'd been out of town for 3 weeks, and I was out of cash. So I wrote a check. You know, this is how I was operating. I had probably 17 or 18 checking accounts, and I was just transferring money back and forth and taking money where it shouldn't have been taking it from. And so I found a checkbook, and I wrote a check on the house account for the Cadillac. I didn't know when it was in Florida. My wife got so destitute because the money was just disappearing. And she didn't know anything about where the money was coming from. But she knew it was disappearing, and so she closed all the accounts. So, in effect, I gave the car dealer a check on an account that was closed. So I drove down the street. They tried to cash the check. It didn't work. They called the police. And I'm up in Annapolis, Maryland at the Hilton by the sea there. And the next thing I know, I'm at the Hilton not by the sea. And that's how I got here. The detective, I don't know if you know anything about extradition, but when you're arrested in one state on a warrant from another state, they have 30 days to come pick you up. And the state that issued the warrant, in this case Virginia, for every day they didn't pick me up, they had to pay Maryland for keeping me. So as a general rule, when you get arrested like that, you waive extradition, and the next day or so you're on your way down and you appear before a magistrate. And I'm sure you all know all about bail. Anybody been in jail before? You know, they set bail based on your ties to the community. I'd lived in Alexandria for 40 years. You know, are you a flight risk? They take your passport and stuff like that. And you know, are you a threat? You know, are you a murderer, basically? If you're not a murderer or a terrorist, now if you're a terrorist, you're not going to get bail. Well, I'm up in Anne Arundel's finest facility. Believe me, it's one of the worst jails I've been in, including D.C. jail and Baltimore City jail. It's just as bad as those two. Alexandria's nice. Nice jail. Fairfax, I never made it in Madison. I tried, though. I waived extradition. I'm waiting for him to come. And jail is not a good place to detox. They did not show up to pick me up. They came on the 30th day. They paid for me to sit up there and detox. And on day number 6, I'm telling you things I found out later. I didn't know at the time. On day number 6, I went down on the jail floor, and I laid there for 4.5 hours as a result of a seizure. Finally, somebody got worried enough that they went and told a guard, and I ended up in the infirmary, you know, and they shot me with adrenaline, and my heart had stopped. And I lost 7 or 8 days of existence there. I came to back in that infirmary, and the infirmary at the old jail in Anne Arundel County was on the third floor. The only other thing on the third floor is a big holding pen about the size of this room that had about 38 convicted awaiting execution murderers in it. And it was not a pretty place to come off of detoxing from alcohol. And I, my children came to visit me, and they had a special deal because my son flew in all the way from California. So it wasn't during regular times, and they took me down actually where they met lawyers, not where they, still plexiglass and everything. And this, I believe today this was my bottom in my drinking career. When I looked across at those two kids, and I didn't notice it so much in my son, but the look in my daughter's face was, thank God you're where you are. And I was wanting to get out, and she didn't want me out. And I found out later when I had just over a year of sobriety, we were at a speaker meeting down in south of Alexandria in Fairfax County, and it was a celebration meeting, and the lady that was celebrating 26 years, and she asked me to speak, and she asked my daughter to speak. And it was funny, because I told a couple of cute stories about my daughter getting drunk when she was 3 and falling down, you know. And then she told a story about how she called the police detective every day in Alexandria and asked him to do anything he could to keep her father locked up. Tough love. Yeah. And by the grace of God, they locked me up. And at some point in that tenure, I came to realize that my life was unmanageable. Imagine that, you know? Locked up for 30 days and you still thinking you can figure it out. This disease is powerful. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. At least it was for me. I was finally extradited and I had a very loving judge. My daughter also had his ear. He knew me because I'd appeared before him over the years. He knew of all the efforts my wife had made to try and get me committed because of my drinking. And so despite the law in Virginia, I was held without bail on a non-capital case for another 64 days. And thank God. There's a big old black guy in there. He said, son, you got a problem. You need to go to the AA meeting with me. And he drugged me over there. And I started going to AA meetings. And the name of the meeting was The Buck Stopped Here. And there were two, I don't know how to describe these guys other than hoods, from Prince George's County, Maryland, that brought that meeting into the jail. And something happened to me, and I wanted what they had. What a miracle. And finally, I was released on a six-page bail release by this loving judge. And then he did me another great favor, and he told me to go directly to the men's home, which is a recovery home for alcoholic men in the Delray section of Alexandria City. And I went over there. At first, I didn't like to tell this part of my story, and then one of the guys I got sober with in the men's home said, "You got to tell that part of your story." When you get locked up, as you know, you go in. When you get let out, you get out. That's what they hand you. I went in a purple bathing suit and a t-shirt and a pair of boat shoes. When I got out, it was cold. And I had no money. And the judge told me to go to the men's home, which was 5.5 miles from the jail. And he told me to go directly there. So I walked. And there are people that remember me walking up the steps of that place in a purple bathing suit on a very cold, blustery October day. And I'm sure it was a funny sight. But I was where I was supposed to be. You know, I still got there. I knew the 91st day that I could leave the men's home when I walked in. I was at the men's home for 18 and a half months. I went from being a resident to part of the management team. I became the resident manager of the facility for almost a year. In the meantime, I had met my sponsor at the first outside meeting I went to, called the Slow Learners Group in Alexandria City, Saturday morning men's meeting. I still go to that meeting. And I drank with him, and the amazing thing was I recognized him, and at the time he'd been sober 3 or 4 years, and I walked up to him after the meeting and asked him if he'd be my sponsor, and he said, "Sure," and I told him my name, and he looked at me, and he said, "I didn't recognize you." And then the first thing he said to me, "I'm going to tell you exactly what the Clancy Eyes sponsor told him. The first thing you're going to do is get some teeth." So I've lost all my teeth in jail. And that was the beginning of the evidence of the miracle of this program for me. I didn't fool around. I drank a long time. I was told to put the same effort into this program of recovery that I had put into my drinking. You've heard that drinking story. I put a lot of effort into my drinking. So, fortunately, I listened, did what I was told, even though I knew he was wrong most of the time. He's still not always right. He got me through steps 1, 2, and 3 in a very short order. He asked me if I believed in that higher power, and my answer at the time was I didn't see that I had a choice. And that's how I started with a higher power. I was told by him that, you know, a group, even my home group, would not keep me from drinking. He said, "A table's not going to do it, a doorknob." He said, "I'm not going to do it." He said, "I'm a human power." He said, "You got to have something greater than that." And then somebody else, an old-timer, told me that faith for him was directly related to honesty. Because us alcoholics, you know, are basically dishonest people, you know, deceitful, And who are we fooling? You think you're fooling that higher power? We think we are. So the more honest you are, the more ability you will have to trust that that higher power will keep you from drinking alcohol. So I got real honest, and I tried hard, and I don't know what day it happened. I was in the men's home, so it was sometime in October of 1999. I woke up one morning and wasn't thinking about alcohol. The obsession, that compulsion to drink alcohol that we have was gone. And for me, it's been gone ever since. Thus, when this book talks about having recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body that you arrived here in, I have recovered. Thank God. Now I have to maintain that recovery on a daily basis. But ladies and gentlemen, I do not drink on a daily basis. My higher power is much more powerful than that. I don't drink anymore. But on a daily basis, my book tells me I have to maintain a spiritual condition with him. Because if I don't, I still have an alcoholic mind, and I will rest on my laurels. And if I do that, I'll drink again. Flying right along. I'm going to talk a little bit about Madison now. I love Madison County. I had a client who was a real hard-driving contractor. Most of my legal work was in heavy construction contract law. I represented contractors that built bridges and metros and hospitals and schools. And I won a pretty big case for him. He said, "Man, I got a deal for you." And, alcoholics love something for nothing. Involved a hunk of land over here, tucked up in the corner of Madison up near the Orange County line. And it was a farm that this guy had built a fairly good sized lake on. I think the lake was, I'd be guessing now, 20 acres or something, stocked with big bass. And then he, well, for whatever reason, he was going to raise veal over there, organic veal or something, way ahead of his time. He was from Culpeper, I believe. And anyway, this opportunity came along for my client. He ended up buying the thing, taking over the loan with the bank, farm bank or whatever it's called. And so he gave me a third of that. And we used to come down here and go fishing and hunting. And that's when I, one day stopped in the Merrimack grocery and gun store. And, a good alcoholic. I can't proclaim other people alcoholic, our book tells us. But this guy, I drank with him. We drank. We did some hard drinking. He's dead now, John Brown, Johnny Brown. So I can use his name. But I had some times down here, I'll never forget my first introduction to Madison County Moonshine, down in the dirt basement in that store. And he took a mason jar down, there were these metal racks down in that basement. And he took it, and he said, "Let's see if this is any good." He poured some in the top and put a match to it, and the flame was perfectly blue. I said, damn, that's for me. Now, I learned down here, though, you know, I'd done some whiskey drinking with Chasen, you know. Whiskey and beer sometimes, whiskey and other things. But down here in Madison, at least Johnny Brown, he had this cream soda, and he would take it, he handed me that first. And I said, what's this for? He said, that's the chaser. And I said, well, I'm going to drink that after. He said, no, that ruins it. Drink it first. So I learned Madison County chasing down here. We had a time, you know. Ultimately, what happened, 3 or 4 years, I came down here and hunted and fished and had a grand time. My son, who lives in Santa Cruz, California now, and who's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and has been for 16 years, caught his first fish in it. And it was a little bit nostalgic for me driving down the road. I really hadn't been down in a long, long time. In fact, since Johnny died, which would have been back in 96, I think, or 7, somewhere in there, I was still drinking. But I loved it down here. But ultimately what happened is my hotshot client got in a lot of trouble, went bankrupt, and I ended up the only one with any assets on the paper with the bank. And so get something for nothing ended up costing me some money. You know, I had to, this was back before I was stealing, so I had to borrow money, actually, and make an interest payment. The interest payments were yearly, and we almost had the place sold, but I had to borrow the money to make the yearly interest payment to get us far enough down the road. And then, of course, when we sold it, made all this money, and they each got a third, and I got enough to pay back the relative that had lent me the money. And the next thing I know, I get this big tax bill for, you know, it was a hell of a deal. Something for nothing. Yeah. But, you know, I've always loved it down here, and the fishing was real good. The hunting was okay. But that may have been because we were drinking too much and not hunting enough, you know. But I used to come down. I loved the, we didn't hunt dove down there, but he had this place, drove by on the way in. We used to hunt dove over there. I'll get to my part of the story. I don't hunt anymore. I did a partial fist step with two FBI agents. That usually gets a laugh. It sure wasn't funny at the time. But our book tells us, you know, we go to any lengths, and some of us have done some things that, if we admit to them, puts us in a position of going to jail. And I had done it, and I will say 80 people in this fellowship broke their anonymity and showed up and signed letters, and some testified for me to try and impress a judge that I had changed, and I had changed, and the judge knew it. The whole board of directors from the men's home showed up and asked him to leave me at the men's home as the manager, and that they would be responsible, and that they could put a monitor on me. And the judge said, you know, that's all fine. There was a policeman named Wayne F. that was really, he lives out near Front Royal. He was really instrumental in me learning what this program was about, including my sponsor mainly, but Wayne was real good. He's been sober a long time. And he and my sponsor had told me, you know, you did what you did, and, you know, the consequences are the consequences. So I think three of us were in that courtroom listening to all these people. Three of us were convinced what was going to happen. But then the judge said, you know, you have changed, and, you know, I admire you for what you've done and what you're doing, but there's nothing I can do. There was nothing he could do. So I went to federal prison for 27 months. But I went as a recovered alcoholic. And I didn't want to go. I'd be lying to you. I wouldn't be rigorously honest if I told you I wanted to go to that prison. I didn't. But, you know, I was there for a reason. I got to the federal prison in Cumberland, Maryland, and that was probably one of my worst AA days. There were no AA meetings. There were no books. There was nothing. There had been an incident before. The first thing that happened, my higher power, man, you don't run out of a counselor's office and try and run over another inmate in prison. That's not a good start. That's what I did. Fortunately, the guy I ran over was named Jimmy. He was from DeRidder, Louisiana, and he'd been sober 9 years. And he and I started an AA meeting in Cumberland. And I started working with other alcoholics. And I'm going to conclude, because my time is up, by telling you that for me, the only thing that allows me to maintain the spiritual condition with the loving higher power I have, and this is just me, I have to work with other alcoholics. That's it. Bottom line for me. Our book tells us that nothing's going to ensure our sobriety like intensive work with other alcoholics. And that's my experience. When I first went to California, I tried to do it another way. It didn't work. Thanks so much for having me down here. I'm really glad to be back in Madison. I promise you I won't stay away as long. Thanks.